From the Free Press, this is Honestly, and I'm Barry Weiss. One of my sister's favorite icebreakers to ask at a dinner party, in addition to asking people's goal weight, is this. What's your favorite conspiracy theory? There's the idea, the classic, that the CIA killed JFK, or that the moon landing was fake, or 9/11 was an inside job, or that COVID was designed by the Gates Foundation to control the world, and that the COVID vaccine actually had a microchip. Then, of course, there's the deep state, chemtrails, QAnon, the Illuminati, reptilian overlords. And then there's Pizzagate, by now an old chestnut, which suggests that a group of high-ranking Democrats were secretly running a child sex trafficking ring out of a D.C. pizzeria. That one, Pizzagate, is rivaled only by the idea that there is a group of Satan-worshipping globalists and Hollywood celebrities who traffic in children in order to harvest adrenochrome, a chemical which in this scenario is extracted from their blood. Why? Obvious, in order to stay young. It's really easy to joke about these theories and to dunk on them. It's much harder to reckon with the fact that many Americans sincerely believe them. And the reason why is because of the fact that some conspiracy theories turn out not to be theories. They turn out to be true. For example, the government was poisoning alcohol during Prohibition. The FBI was illegally spying on civil rights activists like Martin Luther King Jr. The U.S. government did, in fact, let some few hundred black men with syphilis go untreated in order to study the effects of the disease. And COVID? Well, it likely came from a lab in Wuhan, China. The question is, how do we tolerate and even encourage healthy speculation and investigation? How do we allow for skepticism of received wisdom, which may actually be wrong, without it leading to reptilian Jewish overlords? The past few weeks, the speculation surrounding Jeffrey Epstein's life and death is sort of the perfect example of this conundrum. His is a story filled with smoke and unanswered questions, like, how did he get so rich in the first place? Was his wealth connected to his crimes, either financial or sexual? Was he acting alone? Was he acting on behalf of another group? Was there a client list? And if so, who was on it? Does that group include the American president? Why did he get such a sweetheart deal? Did he kill himself? And on and on and on. And things kind of get more far-fetched from there as those simpler questions remain unanswered. Like, was Epstein's suicide faked? Who could have killed him? Was he connected to foreign intelligence? If so, of which country? And then my favorite, was he running a secret Jewish cabal? To help us understand why the Epstein conspiracy is so sticky and why conspiracy theories in general are so compelling to us, and maybe most importantly, how we might better engage with those who believe them, is one of my favorite guests of all time, Ross Douthat. Ross is an opinion columnist at the New York Times and host of the Essential podcast. It's called Interesting Times, and I don't miss an episode. He has been covering conspiratorial thinking, how to understand it, and what to do about it for years. In part, that's because he himself is drawn to some of these conspiracies, most notably, as he talks about in this conversation, UFOs. In 2020, he wrote this in a column. It's a mistake to believe most conspiracy theories, but it's also a mistake to assume that they bear no relation to reality. Some are just insane emanations or deliberate misinformation, but others exaggerate and misread important trends rather than denying them, or they offer implausible explanations for mysteries that nonetheless linger unexplained, which I thought perfectly encapsulates the conundrum of handling and talking about conspiracy theories today. So today on Honestly, I ask Ross, what is the state of conspiracy theorizing in America? Are they more prevalent than ever, or does it just feel that way? How do we dispel conspiracy theories that are clearly false without relying on establishment sources that the public simply no longer trusts? What are the consequences when these theories go unchecked? How do we talk about them responsibly? And perhaps most importantly, what does he think of Jeffrey Epstein? Stay with us. Okay.
Okay.
Obviously, this is all getting recorded and watched by the Mossad. So I just want to say hello to my handlers that are tuning in from wherever they are in the universe.
They're so good they don't need handlers, Barry. That is the secret of the Mossad. It's always
exactly.
been the secret.
As I know too well, Ross. To read the internet, I would think that I am some kind of operative. Okay, that's where I say, Ross Douthit, welcome to Honestly.
Thank you, Barry. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, I got to start just by asking, what is your favorite conspiracy theory and why?
So, as you know, possibly to their disappointment or despair, probably some of my readers and listeners have noticed, I have developed a weird fascination with the world of UFO speculation over the last 8 years. And before 2017, before the New York Times started running stories about weird things that U.S. military pilots saw, I had almost no interest in UFOs. I was a child of the 1990s. I loved the X-Files. You know, I had some familiarity with those kind of conspiracy theories, but I had never become interested in them. And sadly, I've become interested in them. But I don't actually have some kind of belief about UFOs. I'm not committed to any kind of theory about what's going on. My only theory is that something strange is going on with the UFO phenomenon, and it may be something strange inside our government involving weird Defense Department psyops to conceal amazing military technology. Or it may be something weird in the realm of the spiritual and religious, the subject of our last conversation. I don't know exactly what it is, but it's become frustrating to get interested in a topic and then find yourself always occupying a zone of like people who will act as though they have a great secret that they want to impart to you. This is obviously part of the appeal of conspiracy theories, is that you get to feel like you're participating in a great secret. But then you ask them to go all the way and explain what the secret actually is, and you can never quite get all the way.
I want to get to Epstein in a minute. Before we get there, and obviously this is all related, but it seems to me right now, certainly as opposed to when we were growing up, like let's say 20, 25 years ago, that the prevalence of conspiracy theories just feels much, much more widespread. And the shamelessness of them is pretty profound. So I watched a clip the other day, I don't even know how I came across it, of Lara Logan, who had used to be, you know, one of the storied hosts of 60 Minutes, talking in conversation with someone with a very straight face about how in order to succeed in Hollywood, you need to sacrifice either your parent or your firstborn child. So that's sort of out there at one end.
Everyone
of the
knows that that's actually true. Political commentary. But
Right. Yeah. Right. Help diagnose this, Ross. What's going on here?
I mean, so at one level, what you're talking about is just the phenomenon of how the internet has changed political culture and controversy, right? Where, again, I have the view that there is sort of always a large degree of conspiratorial thinking about the world and a large range of strange crackpot ideas. And by the way, in calling them crackpot ideas, I'm not ruling out that some of them actually get things right, right? But there's always this range out there. And, you know, the internet has essentially widened the aperture and widened the number of platforms for people to carry on conversations about topics that, you know, in a world with a more constraining media establishment, those conversations would still be taking place, but they'd be taking place on AM radio at 3 a.m., right, and in, you know, sort of mimeograph newsletters sent around. And now there's no control. And I think there was an attempt at control that sort of peaked around 2020, where you had this kind of consolidation of media companies, consolidation of power in Silicon Valley. And there was this sense that, oh, actually, maybe the internet, you know, if it allows for a certain kind of imposition of conformity, right? And this was something that, you know, you had a certain kind of experience with before you founded the Free Press. But that moment passed and shattered and cracked up and broke down. And now here we are in 2025, and every kind of conspiracy theory, every kind of bizarre, paranoid view about the world can find a platform, find an audience. The gatekeepers are gone. That's part of the story. Connected to that story is just the reality that conspiracy theories reflect a breakdown of trust in institutions. And for reasons that have something to do with the internet, but not only the internet, right? People have lost a great deal of trust in basically every major Western institution over the last 25 to 30 years. So again, absent a kind of restoration of institutional trust, you have an environment where it becomes sort of natural to look for dark, malignant forces at work in high places. And then finally, and this is a point I'd want to stress, conspiracy theories tend to become most powerful in zones where there really is some kind of like dark matter. Like this is the, you know, the term from physics for like a force that you can't see, but whose operation you can sort of infer from looking at other things happening. Places where there's something like that seemingly in play are just natural zones for conspiratorial thinking. And I mentioned, again, my own belief that something weird is going on with UFOs. I don't know what it is, but I think there's something we don't know happening in the Pentagon or somewhere else that would explain some of the weird, you know, leaks and would-be whistleblowers. And the same is true of something like Epstein, right? Epstein is a very weird case. It's a very weird case where there's a set of hard-to-answer questions about how he got rich, how he exerted influence, you know. And maybe the explanation is something, you know, something much more banal than the more Baroque conspiracy theories. But there is some explanation that has never been fully offered in that story that I think, like, I'll be on, like, on the Mossad question, right? I was not, you know, a super follower of the Epstein story. But about 4 or 5 years ago, I had a long conversation with an intelligent, plugged-in person who shall remain nameless, but who was not a crank, right, who was themselves convinced that this was after Epstein killed himself, was just totally convinced that Epstein was in some sense being run by an intelligence agency and probably by Mossad, because given the nature of his connections, that was the one that made the most sense. And I had a long conversation with this person, and they basically convinced me that this was very, very likely to be the case. Now, 5 years later, I've, as they say, done more of my own research, right? And I would downgrade the likelihood that Epstein, I think there, the narrative that this person I was talking to sketched out made sense of a certain number of facts, but there are a lot of other facts that should lead you to think, no, this would not make sense as like how an intelligence agency would actually run some kind of blackmail ring and so on. So I'm much less of a believer, but this is like, this was, you know, you have a guy who has a certain set of connections, who behaves in a certain kind of way, who has mysterious sources of wealth, and like there, you do not have to be sort of a complete and total crank to persuade yourself that, okay, there must be some weird intelligence agency action here. And I myself thought that was likely and now think it's less likely. But you can use me as an example of someone who was drawn to that view, sure.
But I think that there's also an important distinction, and I am not at all an expert in intelligence agencies, despite the fact that Twitter thinks that I am a Mossad agent or being run by the Mossad. There's a difference between being an operative or an agent, someone that is like on the CIA payroll, and a source of information.
Right.
And in most of the conspiracy theories about Jeffrey Epstein, he is sort of like upgraded as a Mossad operative, which to me just seems like extraordinarily highly implausible that that would be the kind of person that the Mossad or any intelligence agency would actually employ. Like, that just goes against common sense, in my view.
Yes, I think there was, I think if you look at, there was a famous case, I believe, I'm going to mangle the facts slightly, right, but where Mossad, I believe, was running someone who was doing a blackmail operation, basically, in an Arab country. And this was some years ago, right? In that case, the person was, you know, no one knew that they were, I don't remember if they were Israeli, but I think they were Israeli. No one knew they were Israeli. They had built up this kind of completely plausible cover story, right? Whereas with Epstein, it's like, oh yeah, are you really gonna you're gonna recruit the guy?
If you're an intelligence agent, right. if you're a paid up operative or whatever language you want to use of the Mossad, are you going to have the former prime minister of the state of Israel visiting your house?
Yeah, this seems like a very unlikely way to go about it. But you have, so what you had for a while with Epstein was several things. You had, right, this sort of mystery of how he got off so easy the first time.
Totally.
You had a now famous quotation that was secondhand and maybe, you know, is inaccurate, but a famous quote in, I think, either a Daily Beast or a Vanity Fair story from Alex Acosta, who was the guy who let him off easy, basically saying, oh, I was told to leave Epstein alone because he belonged to intelligence. And then you had a number of reports and claims that Epstein was in the business of videotaping people who, you know, who had sex with his, you know, with the young women that he had groomed, right? And I think it's easy to see why people would put those pieces together and say, okay, this must be some kind of blackmail operation. He couldn't have gotten away with it for so long if he didn't have some kind of protection. So who is the likely protection? It's either the CIA or the Mossad. It's not like the number of leaps there are not at all extraordinary. And again, I agree. I think if you really delve into the details of the case and try and think about like what would be the incentives of Mossad to have their honeypot blackmail guy hanging out right with a former prime minister.
I just think they have better
it would be a really bold kind of tradecraft.
I just think
be
the like, people that are capable of carrying out the beeper operation have shown a level of tradecraft and sophistication that this guy doesn't have. But let's just take one step back and set up the Epstein thing. I agree with you that there's a kind of there. If you were looking for a case where there is a tremendous amount of dark matter, I don't know if you could find any more than the story and the case of Jeffrey Epstein. So for those people that are unlike us and not total nerds reading the ins and outs of this story, I just want to add for the listener a few pieces. Just factual pieces that have sort of fueled the fire and the speculation around who this guy is, who he was working for, whether or not he killed himself, and what actually happened there. So in 2019, of course, Epstein, who was at the time one of the most high-profile prisoners in the world, was found dead in his cell. It was immediately ruled a suicide. And there were all of these just highly convenient coincidences where the guards were asleep, the logbook wasn't working, the camera was off, that led even me to ask myself, you know, or wonder, was this really a suicide? Was he alone in the cell? Was he allowed to commit suicide? If someone that lived in the most expensive house on the Upper East Side felt the walls closing in, wouldn't he have taken pills at home? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so that happens in 2019. Also in 2019, and this is to your point, Ross, the Daily Beast published this article that said an unnamed Trump official claimed they heard Labor Secretary Alex Acosta say in 2017, I was told Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone. Now, Acosta has not verified this, which has led people to just much further, deeper speculation that Epstein had a connection to intelligence.
I just want to say that I believe that there is a legal document or an interview with Acosta where he is asked directly, were you told, or do you have good reason to think that Epstein was an intelligence agent? And he said no. Now, you know, he has not actually gone on the record and given public statements about this, which is, you know, he's still out there, like Alex Acosta.
But the point is, he hasn't given, like, another full-throated interview on this topic. It's just kind of hanging out there. Okay, then let's fast forward to February of this year. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi was asked by Fox News about Epstein's client list, and she responded this way, "It is sitting on my desk right now to review." And then later, she too walked it back. She said that, you know, she sort of meant vaguely that she had files on Epstein, et cetera. Roughly a week after that interview, Pam Bondi invited a group of right-wing influencers, frankly, many of the people that traffic in the kind of conspiracy theories that are gaining a lot of ground right now, to the White House. And she handed them these binders, like almost like a caricature of supposed information about Epstein. There was a photo op. And then very quickly, these influencers realized that all of the contents in these big fat binders were all public records, and they felt duped. And this further led people to believe that they were hiding something, that there was something to hide. Just two more points. This July, the DOJ announced that there was no evidence that Jeffrey Epstein ever had a client list or that he had blackmailed associates. And Bondi stated that she couldn't release the full files in order to protect the privacy of the victims. Again, leading to more speculation. And then Donald Trump, who had run in during his campaign, obviously he says a lot of stuff, but had promised full release, open kimono, you're going to know everything that was in there, is basically saying to all of my followers that are obsessed with Epstein, I don't want you as my supporters anymore. Stop wasting time and energy on Jeffrey Epstein. If you do so, you're a loser. You're a tool of the Democrats and the deep state. Move on. So when you look at all of, and I'm sure there's more pieces that even I'm leaving out, but if you look at that set of data points together, how can you not spiral into a crazy conspiracy theory? Because the president is acting like there's something to hide. And so is his attorney general.
Well, and that's part of what's fascinating is that the valence of the conspiracy theorizing has now totally shifted, right? So for a very long time, the dominant speculation about Epstein was, as you said, the province of conservatives, right-wing influencers, people in MAGA world, because there was this sense that, you know, this was something that implicated prominent Democrats, prominent liberals, people associated with Harvard University, famous scientists, that this was sort of like, you know, Epstein was at the center of a kind of network of blue America elites. And yes, he was also hung around with Donald Trump and so on. But basically, if there was a conspiracy theory, it was a liberal-coded conspiracy theory. And just in the last 2 months, right, you've watched as Trump has behaved totally bizarrely around the issue, you've watched this swing and become a zone of frantic, fevered speculation on the left, where the idea now is that this is Trump's Watergate, right? And that there is some, you know, there is some secret here about Trump that is so, you know, so dark and poisonous that he's willing to stonewall and betray his own followers in ways he hardly ever does in order to cover it up. It's been really interesting to watch, you know, not that they're going in for the most fevered conspiracy theorizing, but a publication like The Bulwark, for instance, right? Which is a sort of vehemently anti-Trump publication, which was not giving the Epstein allegations like the time of day for most of the runtime of this scandal, has suddenly switched into like full coverage mode, right? And it's like, you know, Bill
Kristol.
That's
because it's politically terrible for Trump.
Because it's politically terrible for Trump. But there also is this newfound sense that there, whatever the dark matter here is, it's bad for Trump. Whereas until recently, the assumption was if there's any dark matter here, it's bad for, you know,
Clinton,
Bill Gates, any of the various figures who were sort of in Epstein's web. So I did an interview for my own podcast with Julie K. Brown, who is a reporter for the Miami Herald, who broke the story, right? And in that conversation, I tried to focus on, you know, what are the actual unresolved questions here, right? And her view was that, you know, the big unresolved questions are basically, how did Epstein get rich? How did he make so much money as someone who was some kind of financial advisor for, you know, the billionaire Les Wexner, who ran Victoria's Secret and a few other people? But he had an outsized amount of money. And then are there other men who, you know, were guilty of sex crimes, basically? She was quite skeptical of the full, you know, the full intelligence operative narrative and thought, you know, at most he was like a conduit of information. I think there is a possible version of this story where the dark matter at the heart of the whole scandal is that Epstein was just a shady money guy, right? Mm. And was, you know, from the 1980s onward, was really good at doing shady financial transactions. That was his value to other rich people. He used that wealth to basically buy tolerance for his, you know, his sex crimes. But the money was actually, like, this was primarily a money story, secondarily a sex story. So if you want to tell the version of the story in which the most lurid theories are just wrong, that's the most plausible version of the story, where there is dark matter here, but it's all really about what Epstein did with money. And maybe that's true. And maybe that's true. I think that's possible.
But I think the version that most people that I know that had some proximity to his world believe is that his fundamental business was essentially compromise, blackmail on people, and that he had some kind of massive amount of information on Les Wexner, because how do you explain why Les Wexner would give him a home on the Upper East Side,
right,
power of attorney, and so many other things? And the question then becomes, and people can run wild with speculation, is what did he have on Les Wexner?
Yes, and that was my, I mean, that was basically, again, like, the first time I sort of went deep and tried to understand the story, that was basically my view, that there had to be a substantial amount of blackmail involved. There were enough reports about videotapes and enough weird things in the story to suggest that maybe Les Wexner originally, and then presumably some larger circle of powerful people, were, you know, essentially like, maybe it wasn't formal blackmail, but it was like, okay, you did this thing with this girl in my house. We both know that happened. Now you're in my debt. That was sort of an essential part of the story. I'm just trying to say there could be another version where the thing that Epstein did for rich people was more about money, and there was either no blackmail or there was a kind of like a knowingness, right, where it was like, okay, you know, I know what happened with this girl who went in to give you a massage. I'm never going to formally blackmail you, but like, you're my friend now. I have expectations there. That's a possible way of looking at the story. The other wrinkle, of course, is that a number of the women, no longer young women, originally young women, who have accused Epstein have themselves veered into remarkable conspiracy theories. And this sometimes doesn't get covered or mentioned. There's a certain kind of embarrassment about this because they are either victims or presumed victims, right? But the woman, Virginia Giuffre.
Giuffre,
thank you, yes. And she, you know, she was the only person who publicly accused famous people other than Epstein. She accused Prince Andrew, and there was a photograph of him with her, and he settled. He was the only big name person who settled. She accused Alan Dershowitz and then backed off, and he sued her and so on. And that, she later said maybe she got it wrong and it wasn't him. But she made a large number of sort of lurid conspiratorial allegations that didn't seem to hold up. And then there was another woman who, you know, has made accusations against Epstein. I believe it's the woman who, you know, had been featured as someone who had a connection to Trump as well, who also has done interviews where she's in kind of like, you know, anti-Semitic lizard people level conspiracy theories. And, you know, so I don't even know exactly how you should interpret that. Like, you can interpret it in as a way of like partially exonerating Epstein and saying, well, maybe we should discount more of the accusations themselves. You can interpret it to say the kind of people who go through an experience like this are then prone to being drawn into conspiracy theories. But there's just levels upon levels here of things that, sort of everyone who's connected to the case is drawn to one kind of conspiracy theory or another, I think.
Ross, you wrote this piece in 2021 that I commend to everyone, and we'll put it in the show notes, called A Better Way to Think About Conspiracies. And here's sort of a toolkit that you prescribe in the essay as a good way, sort of like a good filter, a good sieve for conspiracy theories as we trot through this sort of field full of landmines. Number one, you say, prefer simple theories to baroque ones. Number two, avoid theories that seem tailored to fit a predetermined conclusion. Number three, take fringe theories more seriously when the mainstream narrative has holes. And four, just because you start to believe in one fringe theory doesn't mean you have to believe them all. So apply these four principles, please, to the Epstein case.
Well, so again, one of the reasons that I originally found the intelligence theory, whatever it might be, about Epstein persuasive was that it seemed to fit in theory number one, right? It was like you want a simple theory, right? You don't want a incredibly Baroque theory. And a simple theory is this guy had an intelligence connection. That's why he was protected even as he was gathering blackmail on people. Simple as, right? Again, I think that theory is less likely. So I've sort of gone looking for another simplifying theory. And so the theory I've just been sketching for you, where primarily Epstein's shadiest activities were financial, and that provided a kind of protection for his sexual behavior, which maybe yielded some sort of protective relationships, but wasn't a huge nest of blackmail. That's what I've sort of come to as like one of the simpler, try and reduce this to a non-Baroque narrative, right?
Do you think the following theory would qualify as simple or Baroque? Jeffrey Epstein was a highly charismatic con man. His business, such as it was getting compromising information on people and using that compromising relationship to extract money, favors, influence, and power from them. And he was politically neutral in the sense that he was willing to build those kinds of relationships with everybody, as long as they had power and influence, whether they were in the fields of math, science, politics, business, Hollywood, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And because so many people were in his network, so many people had incentives to keep him from going down. Is that simple or Baroque?
I think that's relatively simple in the sense that it doesn't require a complex political dimension in the way that the intelligence theory does. The weakness of that theory is that it's, and this is again, a reason to sort of maybe privilege the money over the sex. It's striking that we haven't had any other prominent men, except for Prince Andrew in this sort of weird way, actually publicly named, sued, and so on in a successful way, right? And in order to explain that, if there are lots and lots of these men, if lots of famous men had sex with teenage girls because of Jeffrey Epstein, and none of it has come out, then you need, I think, some kind of extra Baroque element where it's like Donald Trump is sitting around and he's like, look, you know, it would be too disruptive to the American order to reveal that these guys in Silicon Valley and these guys in Washington, you know, maybe, you know, Israeli politicians, whoever else, were all compromised by Epstein. And so we have to cover that up. That, I mean, that seems Baroque, right? So then, again, this pulls me back towards saying maybe there was just less of that kind of sex than I would have assumed, right? If you're trying to simplify a little more, maybe it is the case that mostly Epstein used the girls for sex himself. Maybe a few people. I find it hard to believe that no powerful man hanging out in Epstein's orbit ever had sex with girls recruited to give Epstein massages and have sex with him. I just find that implausible.
I think they all did. No.
But you think they all did. You think they all did?
Maybe not all.
But a lot of them.
A lot of them.
So now I'll play the debunker, right? You're the conspiracy theorist. Why don't we know about like one or two more of them? With all the attention on this story, why don't we have one or two plausible witnesses who are like, look, if I have a successful suit against this person, and, you know, Virginia Giuffre did get Prince Andrew to settle with her, right? Like, why wouldn't you have a few more lawsuits, a few more public revelations that actually finger Tycoon X, Celebrity Y.
Okay, here would be the argument.
Yep.
Money, meaning people could have been paid off. People could have been terrified of coming forward. None of the people in these powerful circles would ever point the finger. So that would leave it to the Virginia Giuffre type women. And they did come, some of them did come forward. And many others of them probably had their lives destroyed, didn't feel it was worth it, were too scared, fearful. Not enough journalists were looking into it, too difficult a story. I mean, I think it's pretty easy to answer to that.
I guess my feeling is that makes sense if we're talking about like a handful of powerful men and a handful of girls or young women. Again, well, girls legally for this to be, an actual sex crime. I guess it just makes me think when people are like, well, it's hundreds of these girls and dozens of powerful men, I become more skeptical. And by the way, this is also my running frustration with claims about UFOs, right? I feel like the bigger the secret, the more likely it is that someone would have come forward with something more credible than what we have right now. So I have been sort of pulled back towards a more limited theory of how many powerful men. I don't think the number was zero, knowing what I know about powerful men, but I'm less convinced that it would be dozens and dozens of men.
Well, here would be the argument of why it wouldn't be dozens and dozens of men and why I'm wrong and you're right. Nothing stays, my feeling is just nothing in life ever stays a secret, ever. Everything always comes out. So it would have come out if it were dozens and dozens of men.
Right. Okay, but then right? I can argue against that.
But then that gets us back to the OG things, conspiracy
theory. Right, well, things do stay secret, right? So like, for instance, when the Me Too scandals hit, I knew a lot of people. I know people who work in Hollywood. I have friends in Hollywood, right? And there was a really strong sense that like there was a whole world well beyond Harvey Weinstein, that there were just lots and lots of these stories waiting to come out, right? And instead, what you got was things like the lawsuits against a figure like Bryan Singer, who was the director of the X-Men movies. He had a couple people come forward accusing him of sex crimes. And then those people seemed to have, you know, big holes in their, right? They were discreditable figures. I think at least one of them dropped the lawsuit or anyway. And then there was relatively little follow-up until you get to, you know, the sort of P. Diddy era, right? But I have the strong sense that there is a lot of secret, you know, secret sex crimes in Hollywood, not at the level that you mentioned earlier where every star has, you know, performed some awful act to become a star. But there's a lot of stuff in Hollywood, I think, that despite Me Too, despite all the media attention, never came out, right? So some secrets do stay secret. I think that's true.
Just one more beat on Trump and his pretty bizarre behavior, given how headstrong, let's just say, Trump usually is, how he never wavers. The amount of flip-flopping going on here is bizarre. And Pam Bondi says she's not releasing the files because of the privacy of the victims. Okay, that's her line.
Right.
But there are two other potential reasons, at least, I can see that she wouldn't want to release the files. One is that after years of Trump and his allies sort of fanning the flames, there's not really a lot there. And releasing the files would reveal that the whole thing was sort of an exaggeration. I think that that's less plausible. And the second argument would be that the files implicate very powerful people, including Trump himself in some way. And that's why they don't want to release them. What do you think is going on here? And how do you ultimately think it's going to play out?
If we split the difference, we can say there is probably a lot of stuff in those files that mentions powerful people in ways that connect them to Epstein that is not legally actionable. That constitutes like the so-and-so was in a room, so-and-so was at a party, so-and-so, you know, there's probably hearsay. There probably is a bunch of stuff about powerful people that, you know, is essentially like, you know, slightly defamatory in a way to just release it because it's not something that would, that you wouldn't take into a courtroom that wouldn't necessarily hold up at court, that is guilt by association. Epstein knew a lot of people. A lot of people went to his parties and so on. Most of those people obviously were not sex criminals, right? So you can tell a story where there's a lot of interesting stuff in there, but none of it rises to the level of this proves that this person was part of Epstein's web or was being blackmailed by him. And so you can't just dump it all out without, you know, you're protecting some of the victims, but you're also protecting people who were just, you know, in Epstein's orbit, as lots of people were. And then you could say further, Trump was in that orbit. So there's probably, and this I think is almost certainly true, there's probably a lot of things, mentions of Trump in context that, given who Epstein was, are embarrassing, that don't prove that Trump was himself a sex criminal, and Trump doesn't want to be embarrassed, right? I guess that would be the most likely thing, I guess. I mean, what? But also, what constitutes embarrassment, right? So the the story that the Wall Street Journal has, that Trump wrote that message in Epstein's birthday book, right? Like, that's a message that, you know, doesn't prove that Donald Trump was a sex criminal at all. But it's really weird and embarrassing, right? That you wrote this bizarre, innuendo-laden, winking message to a guy who was a sex criminal. So I guess you could just say, well, it's that kind of thing compounded, and Trump doesn't want that out. Or Trump has incentives as someone who is the president and part of a network of powerful people not to embarrass dozens and dozens of powerful people. I don't know. Those are stories you could tell. I do think it's very unlikely that the files that, you know, any that his attorney general had or that anyone have would contain some kind of smoking gun that would prove that Donald Trump was himself committing sex crimes. That seems very unlikely given everything else we sort of know from the story. Trump was never cited, you know, in the lists of people who were sort of closest to Epstein in the most suspicious ways. Trump was never on that list. I don't know. It seems unlikely.
The thing I find strange is, in my view, there were people that were clearly very, very close to Epstein whose relationships remain somewhat of a mystery, like Les Wexner. And then there were people like Trump who were sort of broadly in his circle and were public about their relationship with him. I mean, Trump told New York Magazine in 2002, "I've known Jeff for 15 years, terrific guy." I'm quoting, "He's a lot of fun to be with. It's even said he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. No doubt about it, Jeff enjoys his social life." You know, Trump is currently suing the Wall Street Journal over this letter that he put in this Jeffrey Epstein birthday book that Ghislaine Maxwell put together. I have no doubt in my mind that if the Journal printed it, the letter is absolutely true. So, like, why is it all bubbling up right now? Why is the Jeffrey Epstein stuff politically, if you could switch your mind from conspiracy to political, why this is bubbling up right now? And what are the ways that certain parts of the MAGA coalition, how are they using this to sort of run an insurgency, you could say, against Trump, if you see it that way?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, look, it's bubbling up now because the Trump administration made a set of promises and didn't fulfill the promises, right? Like
they
created the situation that they're in now. Nobody, you know, no influencer, nobody on the internet created this trap. They created it 100% themselves. Now, you could say Trump didn't really create it so much as people around him. Trump, if you look, you know, he clearly was not enthused about bringing all this to light. If you watch, like, Fox News did an interview with him during the campaign where he said, oh, I think a lot of stuff in the files might, you know, might not be true, right? So you could say that Trump was sort of trapped by his own base into promising a set of things, then they didn't deliver them, and boom, you have the landscape we're in now. Now, in terms of how it's being picked up and used, yes, I think it's being used by different groups that are, you know, looking for ways to fight with the Trump administration. It's being used certainly by Democrats who are sort of casting about for a good issue to go after Trump on and have suddenly very opportunistically decided that this is the issue to go after him on. And then you also do have a phenomenon where, you know, Trump has made a set of moves, especially in foreign policy over the last couple months, that have been more in tune with the traditional Republican establishment, with Republican hawks. He's become more hostile to Vladimir Putin. He obviously bombed Iran, despite the fact that people like Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson were warning against it, right? And
Epstein case, to say it back to you, it's like a kind of proxy war for the foreign policy fight.
There is an element of that, yes. And also a larger element of, like, Trump is selling, you know, foreign policy is just one way in which we're worried Trump is selling out his base, right? And the fact that it has, you know, in the conspiracy theories that there is a, you know, a Mossad theory, an Israel theory, right, means that it fits reasonably well into a kind of, you know, a kind of dovish anti-Netanyahu, anti-Israel foreign policy argument on the right, where it's like, look, Trump is going too far in working with the Republican establishment. He's giving Israel too much latitude in its wars. And guess what? He's also, failing to deliver the goods on this guy who might have been a Mossad operative. Those narratives fit together, I think, reasonably well. And there's a reason that they're what you hear from, you know, folks like Tucker Carlson.
Do you think that there's a way to read everything you just said, but push it a little further and tell me if this is pushing it too far, that the Epstein story just maps on incredibly well to some of the worst anti-Semitic tropes about a cabal of elite Jews controlling the world, cozying up to power, using power in surreptitious ways, pedophilia, which has been sort of a big aspect of a rolling conspiracy theory probably since Pizzagate or before. And that in a sense, if we look back on it, like in a sense, maybe the way we'll look at this episode 5 or 10 years from now, depending on the way things go on the right, is that normalizing talk about Epstein as a foreign operative running a pedophile ring whose clients, what do you know, were mostly other wealthy Jews, is about normalizing a way of talking about Jews that has currently been unacceptable on the right and in American culture at large.
So one, yes, absolutely. There's an interpretation of the Epstein affair that fits directly into anti-Semitic tropes. And you see these tropes at work in the way people on the far right are talking about the case. That's absolutely the case. I think the challenge is that, you know, if you want to fight the use of those tropes, you have to figure out, like, what the actual truth is about the story, in a way.
Correct.
Because you yourself, right, 15 minutes ago in this conversation, were saying, well, you know, I think it's very likely that Jeffrey Epstein, who was a rich Jewish guy who was friends with lots of other rich Jewish guys, was running some kind of blackmail ring dedicated to getting compromising material on American elites, right?
Pause for a second. Totally. And
right.
The question is, is his Jewishness somehow fundamental to that scheme or incidental? When you see, you know, the historian Daryl Cooper on Tucker Carlson, the name Jeffrey Epstein is always, he says, the Jewish pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, the Jewish pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. I think Jeffrey Epstein was a con man, a criminal, maybe ran a blackmail ring, did a lot of absolutely horrible things. I don't see his Jewishness as being core to that set of crimes or sins.
Right. No,
that's
absolutely
the whole difference.
No, I completely agree. I'm just saying that, like, what makes this territory so fraught is that you can't just say, this story has been invented out of, like, the anti-Semitic imagination, the latent anti-Semitic
totally.
Imagination, right? The story exists, and you have to, like, you have to actually figure out what the true story is, and then figure out what you're going to say in response to the anti-Semitic interpretation of the story, right? You know, there's a tendency when conspiracy theories get wrapped together with anti-Semitism. If you go long enough down any conspiracy theory,
you're gonna
eventually
hit it, baby.
You're gonna hit it, right? You're gonna hit the Jews. But it's been sort of reassuring, I think, for people who want to cordon off anti-Semitism to say, all we have to do is cordon off conspiracy theories. And the difficulty in the Epstein case is precisely that there is something really weird involved in the case. You yourself think there's something really weird involved in the case. And so you have to find a way to say, I am acknowledging the weird elements here. I'm acknowledging, like, the possibility of an actual conspiracy. And then I'm figuring out, how do we draw a bright line and say, the way those people over there are talking about the conspiracy theory is just rank anti-Semitism. And it's necessary to do it. And I think it's actually healthy in a way. Like, I think the model of discourse that you sometimes get in all these debates where people will say, oh, anti-Semitism is, you know, you can't argue with anti-Semites because this is just an idea that comes out of nowhere. It has no rational foundation. So there's no point in even arguing with it. I think that that is actually often very much the wrong way to proceed. I think there are forms of anti-Semitism that come out of nowhere and are ineradicable. Anyway, you know what I'm saying, right? But then there are features of the world that pull people towards conspiracy theories, and you have to be willing to actually argue about those features of the world. Like, you could say the same thing about, you know, like, Israeli policy, right? Like, can we have an argument about, you know, what Israel is doing in Gaza, whether it's wise and so on, right? And acknowledge that, like, you know, there are people who are not anti-Semitic who get pulled towards those ideas if they become super hostile to what the Israeli government is doing. Like, that whole zone of debate has to be contested, I think, by people who care about anti-Semitism rather than just treating it as, like, a malignancy that comes from nowhere, can never be argued with, and so on.
I totally agree with you, which is in part why I wanted to have this conversation, because I am fascinated with Jeffrey Epstein. Obviously, the case of Jeffrey Epstein, regardless of what happens, is bad for the Jews, as people in our community say, insofar as that he's a Jew doing really terrible things, you know, that may involve some amount of God knows what. We've been talking about it in this conversation. The way in which that story is used to fuel a growing movement in the culture that is rankly anti-Semitic, I find both sociologically fascinating and personally and politically alarming, which is one of the reasons I think it's important to have a normal conversation,
right,
about the weirdness of Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, and also to figure out what is the actual truth,
right? What's true?
But right. I think in the end, being able, and this is where I think the people who on the right and now on the left, on both sides, whose basic message to the Trump administration is we want more disclosure, those people are just right. Like, if Alex Acosta never said that thing about Epstein belonging to intelligence, if that was just like hearsay laundered through a source and Acosta just let Epstein off easy because he had, you know, rich lawyers and rich people or friends with rich people, which is, you know, again, if you listen to my podcast interview with Julie Brown, that was basically her view, right? That, like, this was a case, a rich guy knew a lot of rich people, had powerful lawyers, and got a sweetheart deal. You don't need Mossad involved. Okay, if that's true, it would be great to have Alex Acosta come out and give an interview and talk about how he made decisions in that case, or have a report that said, all right, we talked to Acosta and the claim that he did this because of intelligence was bullshit. Now, you know, even if you did that, of course, there would still be plenty of people on the internet who would say, ah, you know, Mossad, it's even more powerful than we thought, right? Like, they've gotten to Trump, they've gotten Alex Acosta. Like, but that's the part, there's a part of the conspiratorial mindset and the anti-Semitic mindset that, yes, is really, you're never going to get rid of it. But there's a part of it that is just sort of curious, wants to know what the dark matter is in the story, and tends to become more paranoid the more they're denied what seem like, you know, reasonable answers to reasonable questions.
The case of Epstein seems to me almost like a textbook example of the set of conspiracy theories that you have referred to as New World Order paranoia. Can you just explain what that is and how Epstein fits into that theory of understanding the types of conspiracy theories that are rising in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, New World Order paranoia is generally paranoia just about some kind of world government or secret group of power brokers behind the scenes sort of managing world affairs. And this takes lots of forms. It, you know, centered around the UN and black helicopters in the 1990s, and then COVID supercharged it, right? And we don't have time to get deep into the theories of COVID's origins and all of that, right? But it was a somewhat similar case where you had a genuine mystery at the heart of the origins of the pandemic, and then a kind of flailing, bizarre international response. And out of that combination, you had a lot of people who became convinced that, you know, either in the most extreme form, that COVID had been engineered for some kind of sinister purpose in the less extreme form that the World Economic Forum and you know a bunch of power brokers were using it to impose their will on the world. And Epstein, yeah, the Epstein story was sort of taken up into this world where it was like, okay, these global power brokers also like to hang out with their good friend Jeffrey Epstein and, you know, have sex with underage girls. That theory is different. I mean, as long as we're doing taxonomies, it's a bit different from the Mossad theory, right? The Mossad theory that you can make them fit together. It's like it's, you know, it's a new world order and a Zionist occupied government, right? You can put the conspiracy theories together. But you probably have your own view. I didn't feel like COVID was a peak for anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. I think we've reached a peak for anti-Semitic conspiracy theories here in 2024 and 2025. And COVID, the theories were much more like European elites and health officials are working, you know, hand in glove to make you all live in the pod and eat the bugs and wear the mask forever and so on. And we've sort of transitioned to a different age in conspiracy theories. But Epstein has sort of endured. Like, again, because the story is so weird, the Epstein theory, you can make it
fit. Because it hasn't been resolved.
Right,
we don't know what the truth is. That's
right.
Why.
You can make it, right. It hasn't been resolved. It retains a fundamental weirdness. And as long as it does, you can shape it to fit any theory of nefarious global elites can be, you know, can be made to be, you know, the sphere around which the dark matter of the Epstein thing is contained. I don't know. Ignore the metaphor, but you take my point.
My point is only this. The way that my way into conspiracy theories has always been through Jewish history. And this sense that in times of tremendous economic or technological dislocation and transformation, people lose trust or lose their mooring into the old ways or the old institutions. They go looking for ways of explaining the ways that they have personally been left behind or the changes that they are living through. And often what that rolls into ultimately is a theory about the world in which the Jews become a scapegoat. Okay, I'm being glib about it, but that's kind of the broad thing. And I feel that we're living through that now. I want you, as someone who is maybe coming at it more in the, I'm just interested in why conspiracy theories are rising right now. Let's put like the Jewish question, as it were, to the side here for a second. Why are conspiracy theories rising in this particular moment? Or is it just that the internet gives us a sense that they're more prevalent when actually they've always been really prevalent? That's the thing I'm really not sure about and trying to understand myself.
I think it's obviously the internet takes theories that were always prevalent and gives them sunlight and exposure and lets them find new audiences. Right, so it's both and. You always have conspiracy theories. They're always part of public life but often behind the scenes. People are naturally drawn to them for good reasons and bad reasons. And the internet creates a new dynamic where they get more public attention. People who are interested in conspiracy theories find each other, share theories, new theories emerge. It's just like, you know, it's a new evolutionary landscape for conspiracy theories. That's clearly the case. And then also, we're in an age of conspicuous elite failure in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
Populism as an anti-elite phenomenon with or without conspiracy theories is a defining political feature of, you know, post-2012 culture. There are left-wing versions and right-wing versions, but the more powerful ones are on the right. So it's natural that you would get more theories about elites being wicked in a period when people distrust elites more generally, and there's lots of clear evidence of elite failure and incompetence everywhere you look. I think that combination generally suffices to explain the era that we're living in now. But I would also stress that then you just also have these particular things that, like Epstein, where the set of facts involved is weird enough and there are enough persistent mysteries that, you know, people who don't like conspiracy theories have to respect and understand why this naturally generates conspiratorial thinking. that is a really important thing to stress.
Elite failure and collapse in trust in the institutions. The question I'm constantly asking myself, less so just as a curious observer and more like for the sake of the world our children are going to live in, is there a way to undo that unraveling?
I think you can rebuild. I think the internet, again, technology puts certain limits on how much consensus can be imposed and how many things can be pushed to the margins. But I also think that people are genuinely responsive to good leadership and political success, right? So like when it comes to anti-Semitism on the right, one of my fears has been that if the second Trump administration ends up being a catastrophic failure, that it is in the rubble of that failure that the worst tendencies on the right will get much stronger. Right. So like, in fact, whatever you think of Donald Trump, you probably should not be rooting for total disaster in his second term, precisely because, you know, you actually want, even in populist movements, you want leaders who can play a kind of stabilizing role, and who people can sort of look to and trust. Like Donald Trump is obviously not trusted by the vast majority of Americans, but he is trusted deeply by his own followers, right? And so if you know, if he is perceived to be covering up the crimes of Jeffrey Epstein or the crimes of other powerful elites, that's actually a bad thing. And it would be a good thing if it were Trump himself who actually sort of—
I strongly agree with this.
Right, for yes. People who could, you know, again, there are people who will never be satisfied with any explanation and who always will default to a new conspiracy. But there are other people who can be satisfied by daylight and by disinfectant and by revelations, right? And whether it's Trump right now or leaders in the future, you want a leadership class that is capable of looking at the things that people are conspiratorial about and saying, okay, here's the thing, here's the reasonable questions being asked, I'm going to try and answer them. Or here are the reasonable complaints and I'm going to respond to them. And to be clear, I don't think we have that anywhere in the West right now. I don't think we have leaders who respond to any kind of populism by saying successfully, here's the response to this that will separate the truly conspiratorial from the people with reasonable complaints. But I think you could have it. And if you had it, you would get a partial restabilization. I think that that is entirely within the realm of possibility.
Ross Douthat, thank you so much for making the time.
You're very welcome, Barry.